Today's May 10th, 2020. Happy Mother's Day to the moms out there. This is Mobile News Podcast 326. I'm Taro Gashimura, good friend John Westfall. And unfortunately, I have to start with some sad news. So, Ricky Lee, who was on, let me count, 7 podcasts with either John or me or somebody else, as well as a mini podcast, the only one that I ever recorded in person, passed away last week. So this is about, I think it was Monday night. Yeah, so it was a very sudden, very unexpected. He was tweeting and doing his usual things just literally hours before. So nobody, including him, you know, knew this was coming. But anyway, just wanted to remember Ricky Lee. In addition to the only in-person podcast I've ever done, mini podcast number 30 with Paul Lawler and Ricky and myself just sitting around a lunch table outdoors. Didn't come out well, by the way, but maybe we'll talk about that later. That was not a good experiment. Should have done it some other way. But he was also with us for podcast 237, which may not ring a bell, except that for those of us in Hawaii, that was the day after the missile crisis. And the funny thing was, I remember that Saturday, you know, aside from trying to contact people, like my wife and daughter were on the mainland that day. And aside from that, I remember thinking, I wonder if I should tell people I might have to cancel the podcast because I'm dead. And, you know, I have to say that thought did go through my mind. It sounds funny now, but I thought, should I tell people we may not have a podcast tomorrow? Nah, they'll figure it out, you know?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I would have figured that one out without too much trouble. But thankfully, it was not as bad as it could have been.
Yeah. And, you know, the other funny thing about the podcast that we did with Ricky is that 281, which again probably doesn't ring a bell, but that was back in the spring of, I want to say 2018? No. It was early 2019. And this is just when the really massive volcanic eruptions were going on in on the big island of Hawaii, which is, you know, there are multiple populated islands in the state of Hawaii. And the big island is, well, the biggest. That's why it's called that. So official name is simply Hawaii, like the state. So the island name and the state name are the same. So the island of Hawaii had these massive volcanic eruptions that I think hit the national news, and you saw homes burning and things like that. And, you know, geography not being the strongest suit amongst many of us. I mean, if you ask me to name where a particular place is in a particular state, I'd probably be wildly wrong too. But, you know, a lot of friends not from or in Hawaii would be checking in at a bunch of us saying, hey, are you guys okay? Not knowing we're hundreds of miles away, separated by, you know, a good chunk of ocean. So we're pretty good, except for the smog. But anyway, Ricky was the podcast guest along with Don. It was you, Don, and me and Ricky. And Ricky's, the first words out of his mouth in this last podcast he recorded with us was, ironically, we're not dead yet. You know, letting people know we're okay. Any rate, so Ricky Lee, a young guy, like I said, passed away last week, and we'll miss him. You know, it's and it's one of those things. You know, I keep saying we should bring in some of our friends on the podcast, and I haven't been doing that. I haven't been inviting people for one reason, because basically the schedule's so bad. John's the only one who's willing to deal with my weird schedule. But yeah, we really need to do that. We need to get some of our friends on. Okay, speaking of things that are not going too well, and of course, my condolences to Ricky and his family, his other friends.
Yeah.
Another thing that's not doing too well was my brand new iPad Pro 11, which you might recall I got not that long ago, right after it was released. You know, it started having spontaneous shutdowns and restarts fairly early on, but it wasn't frequent. It was like once every couple of days, and I thought, well, maybe I've got a flaky application. You know, I've got some pretty memory hungry applications like the various art apps I use for my daily doodle project. So I sort of let it go. But in the last week, it got to the point where it was spontaneously shutting down. I mean, to a black screen, and then coming up with the Apple logo and rebooting several times a day. Mm-hmm. So I think it took 3 tech calls at Apple support. They really didn't want to replace my iPad, but you know, I ran through other diagnostics. I did find, by the way, that, you know, if you go into your settings under privacy mode, of all places, is where you'll find the various logs in current, including what Unix people would call kernel panic attack, well, you know, panic core dumps, and or at least a log of a core dump, not the core itself. And you can find a log file literally named panic with different, you know, unique identifiers after it for each panic, each core dump, I assume. And so it's kind of interesting going through the logs to see what it's complaining about. And it's, you know, not just during an actual, you know, catastrophic event like a shutdown, but also things like apps just misbehaving and making too many calls or starting too many times, things like that. But anyway, interesting stuff. I think I'll put a note on there on how to find it if folks are interested. Well, so it's not quite the end of the story, but the story is after the third call, I spoke with a nice person who was willing to say, okay, we're going to, you know, exchange your iPad. So I've got to reset my iPad today after this podcast to do a factory reset, for which they recommend you do it on a Mac or PC, by the way. You think they just say, oh, just do it from the iPad itself, because there is that option, right? But they say, no, go ahead and do it from your PC. So I'm going to go ahead and do that and wait for the box to come to ship my old iPad back and get a new one. In the meantime, it's a good thing I kept my old iPad Pro because it lets me do my daily doodle unimpeded.
Yep.
But
Apple support sometimes can be very skeptical, but they will eventually, you know, I've always found that once they run through everything, they go, okay, well, guess we swap it out. They don't really hem and haw over it too much. Yep. You run through the whole thing and then you get the results. So I have the Apple's probably the only company that I don't feel that bad about doing those sorts of returns with, because hey, that's their whole, you know, you pay a premium for their services. So,
you know, the other thing is, you know, so this is a brand new iPad, right? And it's under warranty, and also I bought AppleCare Plus. I had to use up one of my incidents. So I don't know how many I get with AppleCare Plus, but it's not covered by the warranty. Which, I don't know. I may go back to them about that, is why it had to be covered by AppleCare Plus as an incident and not simply a warranty of a new product. So I need to go think about that. In fact, I'll just write a note to myself. Why not use the warranty instead of AppleCare Plus incident? By the way, I did cause the second Apple tech support person to have a chuckle. Because the first time I contacted Apple, it's weird. Sometimes you can call them and sometimes you can't. And sometimes you can go to a chat link and I won't say it's random, but it's...
Yeah, it is bizarre what they'll let you do over chat versus what they make you do over phone.
Yeah, but also when you can do it. So sometimes I could get a link to get to the chat. Sometimes it wasn't there. Sometimes I could get a link to get a phone call. Sometimes it was just unpredictable. I just basically used whatever I could. So the second time I spoke to someone, it was actually a call, not a chat. First time I couldn't get a call at all. But anyway, the lady who answered the call, the technician, was a lady, or is still a lady, I assume. And I had a chuckle because during the first call it was a chat, and the person was such a slow typer. I thought it was just a poorly performing bot. And so I typed in, "You're really slow, bot. How do I get to a human?" <You know>? And the first tech support person, "Oh, I'm not a bot. I'm a human. You know, my name is whatever." And anyway, the second tech support person just got a chuckle out of that because she read she read the notes from my first incident, call or chat. And anyway, so I gave our Apple tech support person a laugh. So that was nice. But we'll find out if
I just like the idea that in your notes it was something like customer thinks humans are bots or something like that.
Or at least that one was. And I told the second tech support person, I told her, the reason I thought so, she was typing so slowly. You know, so I thought the bot was having like a memory leak and couldn't respond or something. But at any rate. Okay, so as a one of the outcomes, one of the effects of having my poor iPad Pro die. By the way, it was sort of interesting. So I'm not sure. I may have lost all my doodles since I switched to iPad Pro, but we'll find out when I get the new one and I try to restore it. We'll see how that goes. The other outcome is that I decided to do a doodle using a Windows P PC, a laptop that has a touch screen and came with an active stylus. So you know, Windows doesn't have a lot of apps, which is kind of funny, right? Because if you remember in the old days, when the Microsoft ads comparing stuff against a Mac, they would say, oh, Windows has so many more apps than the Mac does. But compared to iPad, at least for art, it doesn't have a lot. But I did find something interesting. So I found Autodesk Sketchbook. I tried Microsoft's 3D Paint, and it's terrible. So I gave that up in about 60 seconds. But Autodesk Sketchbook. So I did a quick blog item on it over on my ogasawalrus.com blog, talking about using Autodesk Sketchbook as a doodle tool for, well, for my Doodle a Day project. And, you know, as I was using it, I thought, wow, this is really weird. For a free product, it's really got a lot of features. Usually a free, you know, like a trial product or a free version doesn't have layers or doesn't have certain, doesn't have full number of brushes. It doesn't do, well, like lots of stuff. This one had everything. Anyway, I was happily doodling away with it and trying to learn how to use it. And I stopped. I was still surprised. So the next morning, I did some research. And I found out that it being the full version of Autodesk Sketchbook, became completely free 2 years ago, end of April 2018. And it's available for macOS, Windows, which is what I initially used it on, Android, and iOS. So last night, I downloaded it to my old iPad Pro to do my Doodle a Day project. And played around with it. You know, it doesn't look, well, you know, lacking talent. It looks okay. But it doesn't look like the way it would if I use Procreate, which I know a lot better. But I think I may fuss around with it. It's nice to have a nice free tool that is fully featured. There's no add-ins as far as I can tell. The only time you need to pay if you use it in a business or enterprise situation is somebody using it for fun. It's just a free download. There's no... It says you need to sign in to Autodesk, but I didn't have to. It still does everything I wanted to do without creating any account in Autodesk. So thanks, Autodesk. It's a fine-looking tool. So, and let's see. Inkscape, open-source project. I've never used it. I've never done vector drawings, but I've followed Inkscape for years. So after 16 years, version 1.0 is released. So congratulations, Inkscape. Mm-hmm. As you know, open source projects tend to be very conservative in their version numbering in general. And and Inkscape, you know, they spent 16 years before they decided, okay, this is worthy of 1.0. Anyway, it's open source. It's free. Linux, macOS, and Windows. So, and I guess it would work on my Chromebook if I could install it in a Linux container on my Chromebook. All righty. And
I have used Inkscape. Yeah. And I like Inkscape. Yeah, it's a decent tool and very good if you don't do a lot of vector graphics, but you do occasionally need to work with them. Occasionally, some of the vendors we use, I need to send vector graphics to them for silk screening and other, you know, promotional materials and stuff. Yeah. So I'll use Inkscape for that because it's much easier than trying to do it with some of the other tools.
Yeah. So free is good. Speaking of free, so I read in a couple places, but I'll link one to Lifehacker that says that Google Lens will now let you scan and import handwritten text and basically do handwriting recognition on handwritten text that you scan in using Google Lens, which I thought was pretty cool. I haven't tried it yet, but there's a how-to in Lifehacker that I'll link in a blog, and I'll look forward to trying it. And for those of you who don't know, Google's spreadsheet, which I guess is called Google Sheets or something like that, can scan a table on a piece of paper, a table being rows and columns of numbers and or other kind of characters, and create a spreadsheet out of that. So they've been doing some really cool stuff with optical character recognition. Mm-hmm. Okay, John. So that was my blathering on a whole bunch of miscellaneous stuff.
Well, I have a few interesting things that I came across this week. So one of the things that I've held off exploring for a while has been Apple Arcade. Because I already figured I paid enough to Apple every month, so why, you know, add another thing? But this week, with the book done and with other projects done and with the semester wrapping up, I thought I need something interesting to do other than just, you know, watch movies or, you know, work on craft projects and all that. So I did two things. I made two new crochet items. So we've got Santa and Rudolph.
We had a schedule there.
Yeah, so I'm already, you know, way ahead of schedule on a number of things. But I also started playing around with Apple Arcade just to see how it was. And so it's $4.99 a month. You do get a month free of trial with it. And then after that, it's $4.99 a month. It is family sharing included for the $4.99. So unlike Apple Music, where you pay $9.99 a month for the individual and then an additional $5 for the family sharing, everyone gets to utilize it for $4.99 a month.
Wow, that's a good deal.
And the actual games are pretty decent. So you don't get a lot of, you don't get first-person shooters. At least I haven't found any yet. You don't get very graphics and stuff, but you do get a decent supply of puzzle-based games, turn-based games, some arcade stuff that you would think of as, you know, traditional arcade games. The one that I really enjoyed, and I actually signed up for Apple Arcade 4, is called Mini Motorways. There's a developer out there called Dinosaur Polo Club that did a game called Mini Metro last year that came out. Mini Metro, the idea is you're building a subway system, and it's how long can you last sort of thing. You know, eventually your system breaks down, and, you know, but it's, you learn the tactics and everything else. Mini Motorways is only on Apple Arcade, and it's sort of the successor to Mini Metro. You can still buy Mini Metro as a one-time purchase, but Mini Motorways is only on Apple Arcade, and it's basically connecting houses to buildings, and you're building a traffic grid in cities like Los Angeles and Zurich and these other little areas. So it's an extremely simplified game, but it does use real-world cities and real-world you know, geographical sorts of issues. So, you know, in Los Angeles, you have to build bridges over the harbor and things like that to build your roads out. But I really have enjoyed it. And I also downloaded a new story-based game, which is basically what we used to think of as turn-by-turn, you know, pick this and who do you talk to and what actions do you do and all of that, called Neocab. So I've been playing through that as well. So yeah, if you are looking for games that are not just bloated up with ads, which is, of course, I think any non-premium game in iOS is just too bloated with ads. None of the Apple Arcade games have ads or in-app purchases at all. So it's sort of like you've taken a step back to how gaming used to be before it became ruled by fake ads for games that don't exist, which is another thing that my wife and I were talking about yesterday, how all of the mobile ads that we see, if you actually download the game is nothing like it, which is frustrating.
So,
but I like Apple Arcade. I might stick with it after the trial.
Yeah, so there's no, so it's $4.99 a month, and there's no additional cost for games. Because I think Google has some Stadia, but I think you actually buy the games in addition to paying a subscription, which to me is nutty.
Yeah, Apple Arcade, if you think about it, it's $4.99 a month to basically rent the games. I mean, they run on your device, and you can use them offline and stuff like that. You don't have to be connected to the network to play them. But you do, I assume it checks a license every so often to make sure you're still an active Apple Arcade user. But, you know, if you think about how mobile games work, you tend to obsess with a mobile game for a while, and then you might not play it for a few months. And so it seems like it's probably a pretty good deal for most casual gamers.
Are there any good racing games on there? I haven't played a racing game in years, but I really
enjoy
them. There
is Sonic Racing.
Yeah.
So Sonic Racing is on there, and there's a few others, and there's also some sports-based games on there. There's a very funny puzzle game called What the Golf, which is, they joke, it's for people who hate golf. You don't actually play golf in any way other than you're trying to get some object to hit another object. But, you know, the first hole you play, it's traditional golf, okay, get the ball to hit the flag. Then the second hole you play, it's okay, get the ball to hit the flag. And then the third hole you start playing in the tutorial, instead of hitting the ball, you are hitting the golfer. And the golfer goes top end over end to, you know, eventually it's trying to hit him into the hole. So yeah, it's a fun game.
That's cool.
I think there's a lot of replayability and discoverability.
Hey, how would you compare Mini Motorways to something like SimCity, which used to be one of my favorite games?
Very similar in terms of what makes it interesting. Not as detailed in terms of what you can do with it, obviously, because you know, the buildings pop up at random. You don't get to control where they are. The houses pop up at random. All you get to control is where the roads are that link them together. So it's an extremely simple version of SimCity, but I think equally as addicting, because you play through one and each game takes about 10, 20 minutes. They do also sync across iOS devices, so you can stop a game on your iPhone and then resume it on your iPad, or Apple TV works with it as well, so you can pick it up on the Apple TV and play it. But you don't get a lot of the depth, but you do get a lot of the addictive sort of nature.
Nice. I still don't, like you, I still don't know if I want to pay Apple more money than I already do. But $4.99 a month is not bad, and I'm really a casual gamer, you know, John. I've never really become, well, first, I'm not any good at most of the really hard games, you know, the Halos and those sort of things. Although I would argue with you that, you know, at least the way I prefer games, I do like to replay a game a long time, like Civilization Revolution, which I can no longer play because there's no 64-bit version. Or Plants vs. Zombies. I've played that. The first version. I played that for years now. You know, ever since that.
Oh, yeah. That is a good game.
Yeah. In fact, maybe before the iPad. Maybe when it was pre-iPad and the iPhone. But anyway. Although I don't play SimCity anymore, I used to play it like at least weekly for years and years and years when it was on the PC. I know there's a version for the iPad, but I've really never looked at it. And quite frankly, I just like the super simple version that was on a PC. Sort of like I like the simple, super simple version of the first Civilization Revolution. I bought everything else, by the way. I bought 2 and 4 and 6 and 3 and... Well, 6 is the current. I've got that. I just don't like it. And it's expensive. Yeah, so that was quite disappointing. Well, before we get on to the last thing, what was it I wanted to mention? There was something I wanted to mention, but it just doesn't come to mind. That's okay. Anyway, for the last item, since John's book is coming out next month, John? June?
Yeah, it's coming out sometime probably, I would say, July, August at this point. Production should have started with it, but I haven't gotten any updates from them in about a week. So, but yeah, it's working its way through.
Okay, to whet the people's appetites, I thought we'd have a John's art tip of the podcast whenever we get together. Mm-hmm. And so what's your tip this week, John?
Well, so this week it's something I thought was really cool the first time I found it in R, and you know, it's not anything too crazy, but I call it the input method of adding data in. So most of the time when you're working with data in R, you are importing it from a spreadsheet or a CSV file or a database or something. You're getting the data in from some external source. But occasionally, especially when you're teaching statistics or you're teaching how do you manipulate data in R, it's nice to have the data in the script where you don't have to connect up and download a file or download something off the internet. It's just the data's right there. This reminds me a lot of how anyone who used SAS remembers the old cards command in SAS, or data lines is the new alias for cards, where you would just paste your data straight into SAS and run your analysis after the data was in there. And it was very useful if you were curious, you know, if you were just kind of thinking about your data, you could say, well, what would happen if I collected data that it looked like this or looked like that? You know, it helps you learn about the statistical things that you're doing. So the input method is basically creating a string of data. So the snippet that Todd can put in the podcast notes this week, it's basically creating a multi-line string. Of course, R will take out those carriage returns. They're just in there so that you can easily see what you're doing. It has a header. So in this case, it's pre and post test data for a student. So student A starts out with 25 and then they get a 27. Student B starts with a 23. They stay with a 23. So you basically create one very long string and then you nest that string inside of the text connection command in R, which basically tells it to parse that as a data connection. And then you use the read table command to translate it into a data frame. So with really technically two lines of code, even though it's formatted so that you can easily see the header and then each line of data, you've got a way to bring in data very quickly and then use it as you would. You could run a paired t-test, or you could run any kind of analysis you'd want on this, because it basically creates a data frame with three variables and six lines of data. So I just like this as a quick and easy way to show people how to get data into R, and how, especially when you're working with students, how to show, hey, look what happens with an outlier. If we add an outlier to this data, see how that changes things. Or look what happens if we double the data set, or any of those sorts of exploratory sorts of things you might do.
Yeah, this is great. I mean, for those of us who are old enough, and you're actually not, John, but I am, we will remember that when we took our stats course in college, and this is, personal computers were around, but they really weren't accessible in the sense they are today. You'd get, you know, all the stats textbooks. I don't know if they still do. Maybe John can tell me. He teaches stats in college. All the stats textbooks would have little toy data sets with, you know, maybe 10 or 12 or 15 rows of data. Let's call them rows, but 10 to 15 elements of data. So, you know, it's enough to demonstrate how to get a mean or you know, do a t-test or do some kind of quick correlation, on a cooked data set that, you know, it's guaranteed to show you something interesting. And it'd be great. I mean, I remember I had a HP 25C calculator that would let me do like correlation and stuff by just inputting, you know, essentially toy data sets, because you'd go crazy with anything large. But it was perfect for college, right? I mean, do you have 10 observations with three variables in each one, and you can tap those in pretty quickly into a calculator. Else, you know, you'd have to run over to the computing center where there was a terminal or God forbid punch cards, and actually run a real data set, which took time because these are a lot of times are batch jobs. But anyway, thanks for that one.
Yeah. That's you know, you still do have those toy data sets in stats textbooks. One of the things I like about R is that when I teach stats, I can actually let my students choose big data sets.
Yeah, there you go.
Because they're so used to using those 10 and 15.
Yeah.
I have a few examples. I'll be teaching stats again in June. I have a few examples where I have students download big data sets into R just so that they can see real data, because they're so used to seeing the fake data in a sense.
That tapping sound here is me. And the thing I want to remember now that I recall is that in honor of John's upcoming book, I decided to, it revived my interest in R, which I haven't touched in years, but I used to use it quite frequently. And so I'm going to have to relearn it. And I'm going to relearn it by buying John's new book when it comes out. And so I installed R and RStudio, which is a GUI interface. You don't need it, by the way. You can just do everything on a command line. It worked just fine. Actually, command line and VI, depending on how you pronounce it. I always say VI. Or what your favorite text editor is really all you need. But if you want to get a little fancier, you can install RStudio. And I found a really nice little blog article that went step-by-step on how to install R and RStudio on a Chromebook using a Linux, inside of a Linux container. So it took a little bit of time. And RStudio takes a while to fire up. R comes up immediately in the command line. But RStudio, I thought my Chromebook was maybe frozen. but eventually came up and was quite usable. So I'll post a link to that blog item in my blog. So you can find it if you're interested in doing R and RStudio on your Chromebook. Okay, well, that brings to an end a relatively short MobileViews podcast. And so John and I will see you and talk to you next time.